is a hero? Is it Achilles, the legendary Greek warrior who killed many during the Trojan War? Or is it someone like the firefighters who ran into the World Trade Center towers after the attacks of September 11th? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour says that heroism, once reserved for people who did great deeds to prove their superiority, has transformed in modern times. We now value most those who selflessly act on behalf of others. Do you find this to be true? What does the word heroic mean to you? Who are the heroes of today, and how do they differ from the heroes of yesterday? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Todd Lindberg, a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. His research focuses on political theory, international relations, national security policy, and American politics. He is the author of The Heroic Heart, Greatness, Ancient and Modern. Hello, and thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Joy. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We will be talking about heroes first, and given your expertise, we asked you and you agreed to talk about the Paris attacks and the U.S. and world reaction and what that all means, and we'll do that at the end of the hour. So,
sure.
Let's start with heroes. Why do heroes matter anyway?
Well, I think when you look at a society and ask who are the people who occupy the positions of greatest esteem, that probably tells you something about the society itself. And I think in our modern world, the democratic egalitarian world that we're fortunate to live in, that the hero is a figure who is no less willing, in some respects, in extreme cases, to do the kinds of dangerous, difficult things that heroes have always done, but they don't do it in order to assert a sense of superiority that they feel over other people. They do it for other people. It's a sort of supreme act of generosity, and I think that makes the 9/11 firefighter more or less the distinctive archetype of heroism in the modern world. Here are individuals who are doing what others naturally do the opposite of. They're running into a burning building. Others are running away from a burning building.
Yeah.
It's a kind of ultimate form of egalitarianism in a way, not even to privilege your own life over that of the stranger you're rushing in order to try to save. So I think that's something that says how highly we value in principle this spirit of democratic equality.
Yeah. Do you have to be risking your life to be a hero?
No, I don't think so. In fact, I think if you ask people who their heroes are, they'll often say something like, well, my mom and dad, or they'll say, I had a teacher once who really got more out of me than I ever thought I had in me, or maybe it's a coach or, for that matter, a minister, all kinds of individuals. And what are they saying when they say that? Now, some people would say, well, that's just a dumbing down of heroism. That's a kind of diminishment of what it means to be a hero because, you know, come on, what's that? But I don't agree with that. I actually don't think it's a dumbing down. I think what it reflects is this sense that at the bottom of heroism is a sense of generosity, you know action above and beyond the call of duty, in this case sort of directed to you personally. And so that's how you respond to it. You respond to this teacher or, you know, your mom and dad, if all has gone well in childhood, with this sense of, of overwhelming kind of gratitude and the sense that indeed this person has been a hero to you. And I think we have to take that seriously. I think there's a sort of ladder of generosity that begins with just, you know, the smallest kindness towards someone who isn't expecting it, and ascends upward into the kind of modern-day Valhalla, where you find the spirits of the 354 New York City firefighters who died on 9/11.
You write that your mother and your father were your first heroes. What made them so, too?
Well, I think in the case of my mother, she had, for all of her life, since she was a little girl, she had kind of crippling rheumatoid arthritis, which was very painful. And yet, you know, she soldiered on. And my mother also died when I was young, when I was about 13, of a stomach cancer. And it came on kind of quickly. And there was originally misdiagnosed, but there wouldn't really have been anything that could have been done for it, and given the medical capabilities in 1973 or so. And, you know, even though she'd lived this life of, you know, considerable difficulty, she was just sort of indefatigably cheerful and lovely, and everyone around her responded to her in exactly the same way. And I think that was a sort of exemplary case of overcoming adversity. And in the case of my dad, I was an only child. He all of a sudden got the responsibility for, a 13-year-old with a real sense of grievance against life, whose mother had just passed away. And, you know, he really wasn't expecting that. It came as a complete surprise to him. And, you know, in retrospect, looking back, you know, this is, by the way, you know, a period in middle school when nobody's parents are heroes, right? That's not the 12, 13, 14-year-old response to life. But, you know, thinking back on what he did for me, I just can't help but think that it was, you know, kind of above and beyond the call of duty. And there was nothing that he did really that wasn't sort of primarily focused on, you know, my welfare, my well-being. And fortunately, you know, later in life, I was able to appreciate that more fully.
Yeah. And I also certainly thought my mom and dad were heroes. I also thought an older sister was one of my heroes. But I'm wondering, I mean, can't you, didn't people from day one, look up to mom and dad and consider them heroes?
Sure. Absolutely. No question about it. I think that what I'm describing in the book is something that I called the caring will. And I actually selected that term in order to juxtapose it to a term that the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche popularized, the will to power, which he said was what drove mankind from the beginning, from its earliest days. And I think that the caring will has been present among human beings from the earliest days, from the moment even before probably we became humans. The proto-hominids have this element as well. And I think it's very important. I think it makes the world that's constructed of politics and power more livable. It makes it tolerable. And so in that sense, the kind of heroism I'm describing in the modern world certainly has its deep roots in antiquity as well. But in antiquity, there was another kind of hero, and that was a hero who was a much more political and power-oriented figure, and that would be this Achilles, the type of supreme hero of the Iliad, who was able to really just shape the destiny of the world around him based on what he chose to do, the greatest warrior. And, again, there's that sort of life-risking element, and there's the sense of in the Iliad, you know, there's a quarrel that breaks out on the Greek side. They're fighting the Trojans at Troy. It's about 9 years into the war when the book starts. And the king on the Greek side, the top king, Agamemnon, gets into a quarrel with Achilles, who's the biggest warrior. And, you know, the world is kind of shaking in the outcome because this conflict is extremely dangerous. And Achilles decides he doesn't want to fight for Agamemnon anymore. And he goes to his tent and he sits there and broods about the slight that he has suffered at Agamemnon's hand. And this is a big problem. And when you're the biggest problem of the greatest king, you're a pretty big problem. And that's an indication of how dangerous this sort of political, power-oriented, slaying, conquering hero could be back in antiquity.
Yeah, so and you write that the ancient heroes, like Achilles or even Joan of Arc, have no place in the modern world. Why not?
Well, I think that we have a pretty effective way of organizing our politics so that we are not in subject terribly to internal disruption by somebody who decides he wants to assert his or her sense of superiority and take over the world. That's not something that is really very doable in our system, and that's because I think it's because we have a democratic society, and we do have a society in which people I mean, obviously, it's an imperfect democratic society. Don't get me wrong about that, but the principle is sound. The principle is this principle of equality, and everybody has a stake in that. And so there isn't necessarily something great to be gained by setting yourself against it, by trying to, you know, take over the world. We contain our political ambitions. One of the biggest differences between politics now in our society and politics in the ancient world, and much of the world today still lives in the conditions of the ancient world, is political failure is not really a matter of life and death in our political system, in our society, whereas it certainly is or was in the ancient world. And that's a change, and I think in a way it's a response. It's a way that political order has in effect responded to the danger of the heroic type emerging. I mean, think about the case of Julius Caesar. His ambition was so overpowering that even Rome, the Roman Republic itself, couldn't contain it. He decided that in order to be the greatest man in Rome, he simply had to overthrow the Roman Republic. And so he did. It was one of the greatest acts of political destruction, I think, that has ever been achieved. And in its place, he put in the Roman Empire with himself at its head. You know, that's just an extraordinarily dangerous man. And I think, fortunately for us, we have some protections built into the system that make us less susceptible to the danger of that kind of a hero.
We are talking about heroes and wondering, who is your hero and why? Do you agree that heroes are different than they used to be? Or do you think our definition has never changed? Do you have a political hero? Or just a personal hero? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We'll also talk after this break how we grow heroism in our culture. Do we teach it? Can we teach it? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about what makes a hero and who are your heroes. We are talking with Todd Lindberg, a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, the author of The Heroic Heart, Greatness, Ancient and Modern. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Gary on Facebook says, Odysseus remains history's ultimate hero, skilled in all ways of contending. What do you think of that, Todd?
I think that's great. I love that comment, and I think you can do no worse than get into an argument over whether Achilles or Odysseus is the greater hero. It's an excellent way to spend a morning, so I really appreciate the comment. Yeah, I mean, Homer is, he wrote two great books. One's the Iliad, that's the story of Achilles, and one is the Odyssey, that's the story of Odysseus. The Odysseus story is about a man of many wiles, many ways, as Homer says. Odysseus is the guy who is trying to make his way home after the end of the Trojan War, which Odysseus, of course, won ultimately for the Greeks by coming up with the Trojan horse, and his way back was very complicated and very long, and he had lots of adventures, including confrontation with the Sullan Charybdis and all kinds of great adventures along the way, and he's made it through not by sheer strength but mainly by his wits, and I think that's I think he's an outstanding entry in the category. There's one point actually in the Odyssey in which Homer describes Odysseus going down to the underworld where he sees Achilles. He meets the shade, the ghost of Achilles, and Achilles is very unhappy to be dead. He said he'd rather be a serf up in the world of the living rather than just a mere shade down in the underworld. And it's kind of fitting. I mean, how could you have a great figure like Achilles comparing himself to just a serf, you know, a peasant? The answer is that the peasant is alive. When you're alive, life has possibilities, and that's what Achilles understands, that in this kind of no man's land, never-ending underworld, there's just not the possibility that the human presents.
Yeah, in the book, you compare the ancient slaying heroes to the modern saving heroes. When did we start valuing saving over slaying?
Well, I think there's always been that element. In fact, I think that there's a character in the Iliad, it's Achilles' friend Patroclus, who also exemplifies the saving hero type. He heads himself off in a charge into a battle, and he gets himself killed, knowing that if he does die in this charge, that will bring Achilles back into the fight, and that will tip the balance away from the Trojans and toward the Greeks. So, in a way, it's a sacrificial act that he performs. So this character goes all the way back, too. But I think, you know, we in modern times privilege this character precisely because of the spirit of democracy and egalitarianism that we were talking about earlier. I think, you know, when we see other people as somehow like ourselves, that we can then appreciate more fully the extent to which people are willing to sacrifice for others, to behave generously, sometimes extremely generously toward others, to the extent that I did a little study of Congressional Medal of Honor citations. We reviewed them going all the way back to the beginning of the award in the Civil War. And what you can see over time, and we actually were able to quantify this a little bit, is that the prevalence of mentions in the Medal of Honor citations of saving the lives of others has increased markedly over time. In fact, there was just a Medal of Honor ceremony in Washington this past week for an Army captain named Flo Groberg, who actually, you know, took down he was working security patrol for a group of senior officers, and he took down a suicide bomber who was attacking the group, and you know, nearly lost his leg in the process and so forth, but did survive. And, you know, and that is the kind of conduct nowadays that even our military thinks is worthy of the highest kind of honor, and I think that tells us something.
Well, how does the changing vision of heroism affect our view of the military or the people who fight in it?
Well, that's a good question, and it's clear that we still have an important slaying function in the military, right? I mean, you know, our SEAL Team 6 and our special forces and our infantry units actually do fight and kill the enemy. They don't do it on their own. They act in accordance with their orders from civilian authorities. It's ultimately the president's call, and they're very good at it. I think that's something that we've learned over the past many years of conflict. So there's no shortage of ability in the modern world, notwithstanding what we tend to honor in the ability to wage war, et cetera. But I do think it's interesting that, you know, even the military in a liberal society still seeks to honor that thing in society which says, which appeals to our spirit of democracy and equality. The other thing I think is important is, this reinforces a principle that the military tries to instill up and down the ranks among soldiers and Marines and airmen, which is you're not alone out there. It's not every person for himself or herself. You're part of a team. You're part of a group. You're valuable. I mean, it's war. There's a possibility you will be killed. That is certainly true. But we will make heroic efforts to save you if you're in trouble. And I think, you know, that matters to people. That's a spark of motivation that says, the social scientists who study the question of why people fight in battle often use the phrase small unit cohesion. by which they mean, you know, people in a group, a platoon, say, feel that the other people in the platoon are looking out for them and depend on them, and vice versa. So there's this sense that you will do things because of the others nearby you. And by the way, firefighters report pretty much the same thing in terms of, you know, their willingness to kind of to run into a building. They're doing it all for the people inside they're trying to save, but also, you know, for the people around them who depend on them and who have their back as well.
We are talking with Todd Lindbergh. He is the author of The Heroic Heart, Greatness, Ancient and Modern. And we are talking about this changing vision of heroism from the slaying hero to the saving hero. And we're asking you, who is your hero and why? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Ron in Augusta is with us. Hello, Ron.
Hi there. You said I could mention a political hero. My political hero is U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. And the reason why is I'm a 57-year-old truck driver, and for most of my life, up to a year and a half ago, I was grounded to only in-state driving due to a disability. And I tried several times in the past to get a waiver. It was unsuccessful. But my boss asked me about a year and a half ago to try again, because he could sure use me on these short out-of-state runs. So anyway, I started contacting my congressman, including Ron Johnson, Timmy Baldwin, and Sean Duffy. And the next day, I was using their .gov contact forms on each of all three of them. Anyway, the next day, I get a phone call from Ron Johnson's office. And to keep it short, a week later, they called me back and said, "Ron, there is a pilot program that I was not aware of. For people that, in your situation, I have
Ron, I don't know if we need to go into the great details of your medical condition, but I do understand that Ron Johnson helped you get into this pilot program and helped you in your job and your living, your career. So Todd Lindbergh, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, a political hero, but that was a helping act that was provided there.
Exactly, and I think your caller is. We're talking a little bit earlier about, you know, how someone does something for you that you think is sort of above and beyond the call of duty, or, you know, represents, you know, just really superb kind of attention to your personal needs, and that's what makes a hero. And this is, I think, a very good example of that. And you know, it's not. It's interesting because this is not a. You know, this is a case that has, as far as I can tell, no partisan element to it. Mm-hmm. It's about calling on one of your representatives in government, the people whom you elect, et cetera, and then making it work. And that's just a tremendous thing.
Yeah, and I hear that your phone's ringing, so maybe I'll let you pick it up and hang up on that person, whoever's calling, and then you can talk with more of our listeners who call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Rich in Rhinelander emails, "My hero is Eleanor Roosevelt. She was instrumental in moving forward the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the anniversary of which signing we will celebrate at 67 years. I see the 67th anniversary is coming up on December 10th. She not only promoted the generalized principles of the Declaration, she lived them and she advocated for them." So Eleanor Roosevelt is Rich's hero. A response to that, Todd?
Sure. Well, again, you know, I think in this case, we do have a political figure, but we have the celebration here is being conducted on behalf of people more broadly, and in fact, everybody who has a stake in human rights, in that Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So, in a way, it's sort of about broadening out the the rights that they're enjoyed in some places and saying, well, no, actually, they're more than just the characteristics of particular political orders in particular places. They are, in fact, universal. They apply to everyone, or they should, in principle, apply to everyone. So I think that's another example of, really working for others.
Yeah. Do we have any other politicians that you would classify as heroes?
Well, this is very complicated because quickly you do get into the partisan question.
Yeah.
And I think that really does complicate matters. I mean, I think you could make a pretty good case, for example, that in 2008, Barack Obama and John McCain could both have been called heroes, right? Mm-hmm. Obama for being, the first black man to, being running for the presidency and a nominee of a major party and eventually the winner, of course, and McCain for his service in Vietnam and the time he spent as a prisoner and his unwillingness to take early release from that horrible situation. But I think if you asked, if you asked Americans, did a Venn diagram showing who thought Obama was a hero of overlapping, who thought McCain was a hero, you'd have a very narrow overlap just because of the partisan considerations. I think if you look at people like Václav Havel in the Czech Republic, we'll take it abroad so that it's maybe a little less the partisan element in our personal lives. Václav Havel, who was a tremendous figure of dissent in the communist period in Czechoslovakia and then goes on to become the president of the Czech Republic. Nelson Mandela, I would say because of the extraordinary magnanimity which he expressed when he became president of South Africa after the end of the apartheid era and his willingness to forego vengeance against the oppressors in that country. I guess I could go on, but I think I'll stop there to play it safe. I mean,
and I don't mean to go all partisan on you, but I'm going to do very briefly because U.S. Senator Ron Johnson was named as a hero of one of our callers. Let me let Ann and Stevens Point, in the spirit of equal time, tell us who her hero is. Hi, Ann.
Hello. Well, my hero is Senator Russ Feingold, and I've said that for years. And the reason is Russ Feingold does what he thinks is right, not what his party tells him to do. The Democrats can never count on Russ Feingold because Russ Feingold reads the bills, and then he votes his conscience and what he believes is right for the country. He, for example, was the only one who voted against the Patriot Act, 99-1. Following 9/11.
Yeah, so how about not going with the flow and maybe risking your job to do what you think is right, Todd Lindbergh?
Sure. I mean, I think, conviction politicians are something of a rarity in the nation's capital and I suppose in state capitals as well, but there are some and these are the folks who don't really care. I mean, the principle is important enough that you're willing to take the political risk for it. I think that's certainly a type of courage, and it's one that your caller just noted. I mean, people do respond to it as heroic.
Yeah, and how have the changing conceptions of heroism affected our politics?
It's a very good question. One of the things that has struck me, and I didn't really explore this so much in the book, but I mentioned earlier that one of the things that distinguishes the modern world from the ancient world is that the political failure isn't routinely punished by death in the modern world, and that's a very good thing.
Yeah,
we don't want to return to that. But nevertheless, the rhetoric is really quite bloody. The Twitterverse and the blog postings. There's quite a bit of talk about war and threats and all the rest of it. So I mean, we've sort of kept the rhetoric or developed maybe even the rhetoric to a new pitch of animosity. But fortunately, it doesn't usually reflect itself in actual murderous acts. Even though that sometimes sounds like how people are talking.
Let's go to Larry in Marshfield now. Hi, Larry.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning. Go ahead.
Yes, I in listening to this discussion, I remember being very, very impressed by John F. Kennedy's book, Profiles in Courage. And I'm just curious, number one, what your guest has to say about that book, and also, is there a difference between courage and being a hero?
Todd Lindbergh?
Excellent question. You know, I think that book is very widely admired, just exactly for the reason that you've described. And, you know, it really is this series of portraits of individuals of exceptional courage. And courage is clearly very intimately connected with heroism. I think when you think about the things that we reward most highly, again, I'm thinking maybe 9/11 firefighters. I'm thinking some of our Congressional Medal of Honor winners. I mean, all these activities involve acts of extraordinary personal courage. Now, I would also say, though, that some acts of heroism, maybe falling a little bit farther down on the scale, don't necessarily involve huge amounts of courage. And this is one of, you know, we started this conversation with a little reflection on my mother and father, and you know, I wouldn't necessarily say that physical courage was a big part of what was motivating me to describe them as, you know, as my personal heroes. So I think it's, you know, there's a kind of a ladder that, you know, if the master quality of heroism in the modern world is this kind of generosity, then generosity under circumstances of increasing adversity, difficulty, and even danger, are what you get as you walk up, as you climb up that ladder. And again, at the very top, you see this sort of running into the burning building stuff.
Ellen on Facebook says, "My heroes are the people who live among us, suffering from diseases we can't see. Those who get up every day in pain and then push through it rather than give in. They go to work in spite of unbelievable pain. They function well into the night for their families in spite of tremendous fatigue. These are my heroes." So there, we're shifting to the, I guess, the everyday saving hero.
Well, yes, but I mean, I think what the author of that statement is referring to is this sort of exemplary personal quality of persistence, mm-hmm, in the face of adversity. Again, that was something I described a little bit in the case of my own mother, with this rheumatoid arthritis with which she suffered throughout her life. And sometimes you can actually see how much pain people have to overcome, but sometimes you can't. And I think that's one of the things that this posting went to. You know, we don't even know, you know, what people are going through and how much they're having to overcome, and we should be mindful of it. It's important, I think, to tell stories like this, because, you know, we want to acknowledge the achievements that are going on out there every day among us by people who are facing difficult circumstances, because maybe that will help in the first place. Maybe it will help humanize us and help us fully understand or better understand what they're going through and what people like us are like. And also, you know, maybe it'll help inspire a kind of new generation to be mindful of these things as well.
Yeah. Who would you point to as a famous modern saving hero?
A famous modern the interesting paradox of modern saving heroes is that they're often fairly anonymous, mm-hmm, because you know, unlike setting out to sort of slay and conquer, it's not necessarily obvious how you set out to go and save. I mean, I think as political figures go, I mean, and modern is kind of a relative, but if you're thinking sort of modern in the sense of since the founding of America, you know, I think people usually say Lincoln. You know, he saved the Union. That's what's said of Lincoln. That's the first thing that people tend to say. And you know, also became a martyr. He was assassinated. So that would be an example in the current, you know, contemporary realm. You know, I think whenever you get into the politics of it, you get into essentially disputed, contested territory, no way around it. And I think the what you could point to instead would be a figure like, you remember Lenny Skutnik? He was the guy who dove into the Potomac River in January when that plane crashed horribly, taking off out of there. And you know, he and there were a lot of people standing there. And there's a woman in the water. She couldn't quite reach the life belt that was being extended to her, I think, from a helicopter. And there were a bunch of people on the shoreline, including first responder types. But it was Lenny Skutnik. He was the guy who jumped into the water and helped her and helped her get hold of that line. And then she was taken to safety. And, you know, and Lenny Skutnik just got in his car and drove away. Nobody even knew who he was. They had to go find him. You know, he didn't do that in order to win any medals or whatever. He just did something really extraordinary and remarkable at a time when circumstances seemed somehow to demand it of him. It's not something that everybody would have done, because there were a lot of people around there who didn't jump in the water that day. He was the one who did. So I think that's a remarkable example of this kind of saving heroism in the modern world.
Dennis in Sturgeon Bay is with us. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning. There is a pattern noticed in multiple cultures over multiple centuries of the hero's journey, as described, for instance, in Joseph Campbell's book, The Hero of a Thousand Faces, the three phases being the person who leaves ordinary society, performs a great deed, and then returns to society bringing the benefit. An example of that pattern is Hiawatha in the fictional story of how he brought maize or corn to the people.
Yes, that's right. I mean, that the Campbell book is a hugely influential study of myth, folklore, legend, and I actually think there's it's not merely mythical in some instances. There's actually quite a great deal of truth to it. It's that is a very smart and perceptive insight into the typical story of the of the folk tale, and I think it still remains quite valuable. There's a little distance in the themes that I'm developing, because I actually do think that the question of the heroic type is very intimately bound up with our sense of politics in the broadest sense, not in the partisan sense, but in the way in which heroes interact with political order, and essentially the danger that heroes have posed to political order for many, many hundreds and hundreds of years, and the extent to which we've been able to tame, in a way, this heroic, slaying, conquering impulse in the modern world through democratic means.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about ISIS as an example of the slaying hero that our guest writes about. Todd Lindbergh is the author of The Heroic Heart, Greatness, Ancient, and Modern. And we will also talk with Todd Lindbergh, who is also an expert in international affairs and national security, about the Paris terror attacks and how the world is responding, how the U.S. is responding, or how the U.S. May respond now. And we will welcome your further questions on the Paris terror attacks. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Todd Lindbergh, author of The Heroic Heart, Greatness, Ancient, and Modern. Todd is also a research fellow at the Stanford University's Hoover Institution. His research focuses on policy or political theory, international relations, and national security policy. So we thought we would take this opportunity to also talk with him about one of the international relations issues that is currently in the world today. But let me start with Todd, you're in your book, you write that the radical terrorists like ISIS might be an example of a modern slaying hero. Expand on this and what you mean by that.
Yeah, well, I think what we have to begin with is the phenomenon that these fighters actually are heroic to a large number of people alive today. And we should acknowledge this fact. Whether or not we approve of it is a separate question. But I think if we try to deny that, and you know, sometimes politicians speak of these attacks as the work of cowards, I don't think that fully does justice to the phenomenon. But then we have to ask ourselves, why do we not call them heroes? I mean, why do we call them villains? On the contrary, the opposite. And the answer, I think, is because you see in these attacks this effort to impose a way of life on others against their will. And I think that that in the end we find this to be deeply offensive to our sense of our egalitarian sensibilities, our democratic sensibilities. The idea that this is how you should attempt to make a case is abhorrent. And in a way, you could say that if a hero in a kind of purely formal sense is someone willing to risk his or her life for a cause, a sense of superiority inside them, a sense of fidelity to a greater cause, etc., then we also have to look at the content of the cause. And we have to say, no, this is not an acceptable means of promoting the cause. And we can do that because we are the inheritors of the classically liberal, rights-oriented tradition. You know, you talk about one of our callers today mentioned Eleanor Roosevelt and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Well, you know, the ISIS fighters do not believe in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and seek to overthrow societies that do. And that's the kind of confrontation that we find ourselves in.
Well, ISIS, of course, on our minds today because of Friday's attacks in Paris, which left more than 127 people dead, dozens injured. ISIS is taking credit for those attacks as well as an attack in a market in Beirut less than 24 hours before that left 43 dead. What are these attacks accomplishing for ISIS?
Well, I think one of the things that they are accomplishing is demonstrating that ISIS has reached beyond the region in which it is currently trying to gain a foothold of power. So it's not a local problem. It's not a local problem to Syria and Iraq or even including some elements in Libya. It's bigger than that. The second thing it's accomplishing, though, and certainly I think the Paris attacks have galvanized opinion in France and I think in Europe as a whole, that this is just not acceptable and it's going to have to be met. And I think how you meet it is a difficult question and a complicated one. Obviously, we need, there's a sense in Paris now that obviously more has to be done locally in order to confront radicalized individuals who might be contemplating additional such attacks. And then there's the question of ISIS itself at large. President Obama has talked about degrading and defeating ISIS, so that is the United States goal, but has not actually pressed the military nearly as hard as he has the capability of doing. And obviously, I think it's pretty clear that this is not a war that the president particularly wanted and would have preferred to, as he says, contain ISIS in its geographical area. But that does not appear to be working. And so I think the more likely outcome at this point is a broader effort in the region as well, which probably will involve greater numbers of American boots on the ground. But I would hope and expect that we won't be alone in this endeavor, that that our European allies have really had a tremendous sense of a tremendous jolt in this attack, and that there's a sense that that we'd better stand together.
Yeah, President Obama will be having a press conference at 9:30 this morning from the global summit he is attending in Turkey. The specific topic of that press conference is not stated. On Point, we'll have special coverage during our next hour dealing with this. Do you expect that President Obama is contemplating increased involvement in the war against ISIS in Syria, for example?
I think so. I mean, I think there would be a tremendous amount of pressure on him, and I think that that he needs to acknowledge that Syria is a disaster that has occurred on his watch. It's I do a lot of policy work in the area of trying to better coordinate international efforts to prevent atrocities and genocide and such. It's something I've been doing for the past decade or so. When a dictator such as Assad starts opening fire on peaceful protesters, demonstrators, as he did more than 3 years ago now, one should be very wary of the assumption that this problem is going to take care of itself. In fact, as has happened, things almost certainly are going to get much worse. And so now we have essentially a disintegrated state, a massive internally displaced persons, and migration issue that's threatening to overwhelm Europe. We have the empty spaces of political authority. We've got the rise of ISIS, and now we've got indication that ISIS is using the migration and therefore the generosity of certain European countries in taking in refugees in order to seed that migration with its own agents for the purpose of attacking the countries who are receiving them. So,
yeah. And in fact,
a horrible problem.
With our final minute, and just less than a minute, do you see the U.S. changing that plan to accept Syrian refugees?
Well, that is a very difficult question. I'm sure there is going to be tremendous political pressure on this question, as indeed there is in Europe. I think the humanitarian need is there, and that we have to respond to it in one fashion or another. And if that means much more intense vetting, et cetera, then we have to be willing to do that. But I think it would be a horrible thing if the world just sort of closed its doors.
Yeah. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Todd Lindbergh, research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, author of The Heroic Heart, Greatness, Ancient and Modern, also an expert on international relations and national security policy. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Chris Molina for on-air production. Stay tuned for more special coverage of ISIS and the Paris attacks and the U.S. response coming up on Point in our next hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.